Welcome to Legal Listening, where audio obiter is our thing. We're Carly and Zach, and we're so glad you're here with us today. Hi there, just me. I'm about to bring you part three of Frasier in Canada. These are the shortish reasons of Justice Cote in her dissenting opinion. If you want to hear the majority or the dissenting opinion of Justices Brown and Roe, head back to the previous two episodes. Hope you enjoy. The following are the separate reasons delivered by Justice Cote. Part 1, Introduction. Discrimination on the basis of sex is the most invidious order. Like race, sex is an innate and immutable characteristic and bears no relevant relationship to capability. Without question, women have faced a prolonged fight for equal treatment under the law, a fight marked by a society where women have historically been disadvantaged and where they continue to be so today. But that is not the question before this court. Nor is the question before this court whether the impugned legislative provisions are irrational, illogical, or even under-inclusive. That a law is not perfect or even excludes some does not make it per se unconstitutional. Rather, over the course of three decades, this court has carefully crafted a test to assess whether a particular form of alleged discrimination is discrimination in fact and runs afoul of the guarantee of equal treatment under the law found in Section 15 of the Charter. A crucial element of Section 15(1) of the Charter is that it enumerates the grounds of discrimination that fall within its constitutional prohibition. Here, with respect, I cannot agree with my colleagues that the impugned provisions of the pension plan create a distinction on the basis of the enumerated grounds of sex. I proceed to elucidate why. Part 2, Analysis. My colleagues offer a comprehensive overview of this court's Section 15(1) jurisprudence, so I do not purport to do so here. While there exists clear disagreement between them as to certain elements of doctrine, I understand my colleagues and I agree on the following. To prove discrimination under Section 15(1), including in a case of adverse effects discrimination, a claimant must A. show that the law creates an adverse distinction based on an enumerated or analogous ground, and B. show that the law perpetuates, reinforces, or exacerbates pre-existing disadvantage. Here, I am of the view that there is no need to proceed to the second step of the analysis, as my colleagues do, because no distinction can be made out on the basis of sex under step one. With the greatest respect, allowing the appeal on the basis of sex simpliciter is an attempt to square a circle. The effect of the impugned provisions of the pension plan is to create a distinction not on the basis of being a woman, but being a woman with children. In other words, a distinction exists not because one is a woman, but because one has caregiving responsibilities. It is telling that the statistics used by my colleague Justice Abella to make her point, setting aside for now the question of their validity and even their appropriate role in the Section 15 analysis, are all in reference to women with children. The notion of women with children is inextricable from the evidence presented. It seems to me, then, that caregiving status is the only distinction created by the pension plan. In other words, the distinction in this case exists not on the basis of being a woman, but on the basis of needing to take care of someone. One does not job share because one is a woman. One job shares because one needs to take care of someone. Importantly, I wish to draw particular attention to the following illustration. Consider, for instance, same-sex male couples who also have to bear the burden of taking care of their children. Consider further those individuals who bear the burden of taking care of their aging parents or spouse. These individuals, along with women with children, will all be under disproportionate pressure to job share due to their caregiving responsibilities. Those individuals with no caregiving responsibilities will have no such pressure to job share. The impugned provisions therefore create a distinction on the basis of caregiving responsibilities, not sex simpliciter. As I see it, it is essential to consider the nature of the claim before this court. Indeed, the appellants make their claim on behalf of women with children and not simply women. Nobody has asserted a claim on behalf of a woman without children. It is critical to the claim, then, that the appellants had caregiving responsibilities in relation to children that made them decide to job share. This explains why the appellants argued their claim on appeal on the basis of intersecting grounds of sex and parental or family status. However, of crucial importance to the disposition of this appeal is the fact that caregiving, parental, or family status is not recognized by this court as an analogous ground under Section 15(1) of the Charter, nor would I recognize any of them as such here. Indeed, my colleague Justice Sabella provides compelling reasons not to, as do my colleagues Justice Brown and Roe, and I find myself in agreement that it would be inappropriate to do so. Accordingly, in light of the conclusion that any distinction here depends not on sex but on caregiving responsibilities alone, and that this court cannot recognize caregiving, parental, or family status as analogous grounds in this case, the appellant's claim must fail at step one of the Section 15(1) analysis. Thus, at least doctrinally, this case is relatively straightforward. Lengthy reasons are elicited only by virtue of the attempt to fix the claim under the enumerated ground of sex simpliciter. However, it is clear that the distinction created by the pension plan manifests itself not as a result of sex alone, but as a result of a combination of sex with caregiver status. If the majority wishes to allow the appeal, then the more doctrinally sound method would be either to recognize intersecting grounds as the appellants urge, or recognize a new analogous ground. Without doing so, however, this court has only attempted to square a circle. And as a result, doctrinal uncertainty seeps into this court's Section 15(1) jurisprudence and obscures rather than illuminates the way forward. This brings me to my next point, responding to the analytical and doctrinal methodology needed to support the conclusion that the pension plan creates a distinction on the basis of sex alone. First, in order to support the finding that the impugned provisions create a distinction on the basis of sex, without recognizing an intersecting or analogous ground of parental, family, or caregiving status, my colleague Justice Sabella says that, in effect, discrimination on the basis of child care is tantamount to discrimination on the basis of sex due to their historical association with one another. This argument follows the rationale of Brooks and Canada Safeway Limited, where the court recognized that pregnancy-based discrimination necessarily constituted sex-based discrimination. Indeed, my colleague Justice Sabella posits that evidence about certain groups will show such a strong association with certain traits, such as pregnancy with gender, that the disproportionate impact on members of that group will be apparent and immediate. Setting aside for now the doctrinal proposition that disproportionate impact is sufficient to meet step one, I am of the view that there is a meaningful distinction between pregnancy and sex on the one hand, and caregiving status and sex on the other. This case is accordingly unlike Brooks. In Brooks, the court held that a corporate insurance plan which denied benefits to employees during pregnancy discriminated on the basis of sex. Chief Justice Dixon grounded this conclusion on the fact that pregnancy, by definition, affects only women. Writing for the court, Chief Justice Dixon explained that while pregnancy-based discrimination only affects part of an identifiable group, it does not affect anyone who is not a member of the group. The present case is manifestly different. Caregiving status can be separated from sex. In Brooks, an insurance plan that discriminated against pregnant employees necessarily discriminated against women. Here, impugned provisions of the pension plan that discriminate against those with caregiving responsibilities do not necessarily discriminate against women. In other words, caregiving, unlike pregnancy, is not by definition associated with sex. Rather, same-sex couples with children and other individuals with caregiving responsibilities will also be disproportionately affected. The appellants, women and children, are not denied a benefit that others are granted by reason of a personal characteristic that falls within the enumerated grounds of Section 15(1). The impugned provisions create a distinction on the basis of caregiver status, not sex simpliciter. Accordingly, the only remaining way to support the conclusion that the pension plan discriminates against women without recognizing an intersecting or analogous ground or relying on the Brooks argument is to dispose of any requirements of causation, nexus, or tether between the impugned provisions and their effect, and look only to the statistical disparity in results, i.e., women are disproportionately affected. Indeed, my colleague Justice Sabella takes this doctrinal step and seemingly reduces the step one analysis to a mere search for disproportionate impact evidenced by statistical disparity. She says that, in order for law to create a distinction based on prohibited grounds through its effects, it must have a disproportionate impact on members of a protected group. If so, the first stage of Section 15 will be met. My colleague then expresses agreement with the proposition that statistical disparity will be sufficient by itself to demonstrate disproportionate impact. This doctrinal development warrants significant caution, and not just because it confounds a necessary condition with a sufficient one. Disproportionate impact alone cannot be sufficient to meet Step 1 of the Section 15.1 analysis. In other words, simply pointing to the fact that the majority of job sharers are presently women with children cannot in itself be sufficient to say that Step 1 has been met. Otherwise, for example, a law that regulates the top 1% of income earners in Canada would proceed past the Step 1 analysis simply by virtue of the fact that the top 1% of income earners in Canada are majority male. Analogously, a law regulating the nursing profession would proceed past the Step 1 analysis simply by virtue of the fact that the nursing profession is majority female. Surely, the aforementioned examples are not instances of prima facie discrimination, yet they exemplify how, if disproportionate impact alone were sufficient, Step 1 would become a mere rubber stamp in cases of adverse effect discrimination, rather than a step at which the claimant will have more work to do, belying the same guidance from Whittler. Worse yet, if statistical disparities alone were sufficient, the Section 15.1 analysis would in effect be replaced with a green light to Section 1, where the burden is reversed and placed on the government. My colleagues may very well consider such a state of affairs to be appropriate or desirable, and I cast no judgment in this regard. However, I simply wish to point out that such a doctrinal development is not currently supported by this court's jurisprudence. Or if it is, then with respect, it requires more justification or clarification. Relatedly, I express further trepidation over the majority's potential invitation for statistics-based litigation. In effect, as I see it, parties may now routinely proffer and challenge statistical evidence, thereby bolstering their findings, which are owed deference upon appellate review, and which are findings the judiciary is institutionally ill-equipped to be making. The nature of statistics means that they are presented to courts frozen at a point in time, yet in reality they are constantly shifting. It cannot be that the very same law that is constitutional one day is unconstitutional the next, based solely on statistical evidence. On this point, my colleague Justice Sabella's reliance on Griggs and Duke Power is respectfully an apostate. She repeatedly cites Griggs for the proposition that disproportionate impact is sufficient in itself to demonstrate that a law creates an adverse distinction based on a protected ground and thereby satisfies Step 1. I do not think Griggs can be read in such a manner. Griggs was a statutory interpretation case concerned with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, not a constitutional case. Its result was compelled by the text of the statute rather than the principles underlying unconstitutional adverse effect discrimination. Further, as evidenced by its progeny, Griggs is limited in its scope, such that it cannot stand for the proposition that statistical disparity alone is sufficient. Regardless, in hopes of avoiding a jurisprudential debate on case law sourced from outside this country, at bottom, the American tradition of equality is markedly distinct from the Canadian tradition. While Griggs was admittedly a case of adverse effect discrimination, it was also fundamentally a case informed by the unique legacy of slavery and segregated schools endemic to American history. In Griggs, a high school education effectively served as a proxy for race. Indeed, the impugned high school education and aptitude test requirements there were imposed on the same day the Civil Rights Act came into force. In this way, in Griggs, there was a legitimate nexus established between the imposition of a high school education and aptitude test requirement and racial discrimination, and not simply a nexus that depended on statistical disparity alone. While this court has of course cited Griggs in the past, it has never done so to support the proposition that Step 1 can be satisfied in the absence of a nexus between the impugned law and the disproportionate impact. Since the inception of our jurisprudence interpreting Section 15(1), this court has cautioned as follows. Quote, if the adverse effects analysis is to be coherent, it must not assume that a statutory provision has an effect which is not proved. We must take care to distinguish between effects which are wholly caused or are contributed to by an impugned provision and those social circumstances which exist independently of such a provision. This pronouncement continues to be applied in the search for a necessary nexus between the impugned law and its effects in cases of adverse effect discrimination. Ultimately, the question under Step 1 is whether the law, while facially neutral, creates an adverse distinction based on an enumerated or analogous ground. This means that the claimant must therefore demonstrate that the law at issue has a disproportionate effect on the claimant based on his or her membership in an enumerated or analogous group. Although my colleague Justice Sabella's phrasing on the question under Step 1 correctly uses the word creates, she later seems to read this word out by determining that mere disproportionate impact is sufficient. This cannot be the case. To proceed past Step 1 and show a prima facie breach, the evidence must amount to more than a web of instinct. A nexus between the impugned legislation and the disproportionate impact is required. This is essential to understanding why both federal court and the Federal Court of Appeal held that the claim here fails at Step 1. Indeed, both courts found that this case turns on the first step. Applying Step 1 to the facts, they each found that the pension plan creates no distinction based on the enumerated ground of sex. They held the following, quote, the fact that the vast majority of part-time members and members in a job-sharing arrangement are women, and that these job sharers do not have the option of contributing to their pension at full-time rates, is not a consequence of or connected to the provisions of the RCMPSA. The trigger is whether the member works part-time, that is, not connected to the RCMPSA. Rather, this is based on the decisions the member makes, as difficult as those may be, as a family to balance work and childcare by having one parent, usually the woman, work part-time for a few years, end quote, federal court reasons. Quote, the mere fact that women disproportionately take advantage of the job-sharing option does not mean that the pension treatment afforded to those who job-share under the RCMPSA and the regulation creates a distinction on an enumerated or analogous ground. Likewise, as in Begum, the general expert opinion evidence filed by the appellants fails to establish the requisite nexus between the impugned provisions and a protected ground so as to give rise to a Section 15 breach. In sum, the appellants were not denied buyback rights based on their personal characteristics of being female RCMP members with young children, but rather because they elected to job share as opposed to taking care and nurturing leave. The requisite nexus to establish a breach of Section 15 of the Charter is therefore absent in this case, as the appellants cannot show that the impugned provisions in the RCMPSA and regulation impact them more negatively than others because of their sex, end quote. Federal Court of Appeal reasons. My colleague Justice Sabella rejects this reasoning and its emphasis on choice, and my colleagues Justice Brown and Roe, by implication of finding that the appellants have satisfied Step 1, also seem to reject this reasoning. I need not express any consideration in this regard, because in any case, no distinction can be demonstrated here on the basis of sex. As I have established, it is hard to see how the impugned provisions create a distinction on the basis of being a woman alone. I reiterate that one does not job share because one is a woman. One job shares because one has caregiving responsibilities. The claim brought by the appellants on behalf of women with children crucially depends on the intersection of sex and parental or family status. The arguments proffered and statistics employed are all in reference to women with children. Like my colleague Justice Sabella, I accept the appellant Ms. Fox's evidence that job sharing is often the only child care solution for members with children because there is simply no around-the-clock child care available in rural or isolated communities. But there is no reason why this is a singularly sex-based issue. Rather, it is a caregiver status issue. For instance, in those same rural or isolated areas, there is likely no around-the-clock elderly care available either, making job sharing the only solution available for members with caregiving responsibilities. Thus, the burden to job share and the associated distinction created by the impugned provisions of the pension plan is faced by those members with caregiving responsibilities and is not limited to those of a certain sex. Indeed, those without such responsibilities do not face any comparable pressure to job share. But without recognition of an analogous protected ground of parental, family, or caregiver status, or alternatively the intersection of that ground and sex, the appellant's claim must fail at step one of the Section 15(1) analysis. To be sure, the impugned provisions may very well not be rational. There may indeed be no logical reason to deprive job sharers of full pension benefits that are guaranteed to full-time members and members on leave without pay. But it is not this court's role to constitutionalize normative judgments to this effect. That is the role of the electorate and, in turn, the legislature. In this sense, I wish to add one final point on the role of the judiciary vis-a-vis the role of the legislature. The result the majority reaches may certainly be desirable insofar as it guarantees the opportunity for increased pension benefits to RCMP members who job share. But when the court reaches this result in such a doctrinally precarious fashion, and when and if the impugned provisions are illogical, irrational, or under-inclusive, then it is the legislature's role to rectify. The remedy does not lie in the Constitution, which prescribes particular forms of discrimination, forms that do not exist here. With the greatest respect, then, the remedy sought in the case at bar should be granted by the democratic process. Part 3. Conclusion. While I agree with Justice Abella that sex-based discrimination is particularly insidious, and I similarly lament society's continued history of discrimination against women, I am in respectful disagreement as to whether the appellants have sufficiently made out a Section 15 violation here under this court's well-established jurisprudence. Likewise, while I agree with my colleagues Justices Brown and Rose's proposed disposition on the appeal, as well as with their observations regarding the appellant's employment status and the majority's unprincipled expansion of the scope of Section 15(1), I write separately to express disagreement with their dismissal of the appeal on the second step of the Section 15(1) analysis rather than at the first step, which is the step on which this case turns. Further, I write separately in order to highlight the under-inclusive nature of the pension plan, which disproportionately affects all those with caregiving responsibilities, including same-sex couples with children, and individuals with caregiving responsibilities for their aging partners or parents. It therefore falls to the legislature, not the courts, to remedy any under-inclusiveness in this legislation, which was purportedly meant to assist with caregiving responsibilities in the first place. For these reasons, and with the greatest respect for my colleagues, I would dismiss the appeal.
Thanks for the listen, friend. I hope you're able to enjoy that case and learn something new from it. Legal Listening is founded by Zach Battiston and Carly Lyons. It is hosted by Zach Battiston, Carly Lyons, and you, our listeners. Executive produced by Zach Battiston, Carly Lyons, and Anthony Radomile. Audio engineering by Anthony Radomile. Graphic design by Julie Lundy. Check her out online at julielundyart.com. And music done by Matt Radomile at radankel.com. At Legal Listening, we're always open to new ideas, suggestions, and of course, guest readers. Check us out on Twitter at Legal Listening or online at legallistening.com. Legal Listening, where audio obiter is our thing. We'll catch you in the next case. Bye now.